you will then receive
Morning, Chair, and honourable members of the Portfolio Committee on Public Administration, Service and Administration. Let me also acknowledge the presence in this meeting of the Director General of the Department of Public Service and Administration and Senior Management present here this morning. I think also we will have in our midst the Commissioners and Acting Chairperson of the Public Service Commission, and members of the public. Chair, indeed, in terms of the program, I think you've just indicated two of the items that I would like to actually introduce. The first item being a submission received by the Office of the Speaker from the Civil Society Seventh Pension Redress Movement, requesting Parliament to assist current and former public servants who were discriminated against under apartheid in respect of pension redress program. Chairperson, I've been made to understand that this submission that was in the form of a petition that comes from this movement was actually then presented to the Office of the Solicitor General for a legal opinion. The presentation will actually elaborate on this. I don't know whether I should actually also get into the lifestyle audit or should just pause here until we come to the lifestyle audit and then I can introduce the lifestyle audit. If you agree, Chair, can I then present to you the DG of the Department of Public Service and Administration, Mayor Lisa McCarthy, for her to make the presentation.
Thank you, DM. Lisa, you can take the floor.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to members of the committee. Chairperson, I'm going to ask, there's two colleagues on standby who are going to make the presentation. The first one is Ms. Nomsa Khilikane, who's going to be making the presentation on the pensions. And she will be followed by Dr. Solomon, who will be making a presentation on the update of lifestyle audit. Chairperson, I request that you allow them to make the presentation. And I do want upfront, Chair, to also request to excuse myself for a few minutes at 11 o'clock. There's an interview I need to take, and I'll quickly join back the meeting. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Over to you, Nomsa.
Thank you, Yoliswa. Okay, you are granted that permission.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, DM. Good morning, DG.
Good morning, everybody.
My name is Nomsa Khelitjane. I'm responsible for macro benefits in the public service. I'd like to give just a brief summary. As the DM has already mentioned, that the former Speaker of National Assembly, Honorable Ms. Thandi Modise, received a petition from this community-based non-profit organization.
Sorry, Nomsa, before you start, your presentation is not showing on the screen.
Yes, it is not showing, Yoli. I mean, Nomsa, can you? Yeah, it is now coming up.
Please put it on presentation format. Yep.
Okay. Everything is okay now. I was still mentioning that the presentation, okay, has been done in collaboration with the Government Pensions Administration Agency, specifically the area dealing with applications and the status of the applications. Also, a legal opinion was sourced from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor to determine whether the state as the employer is under any legal or constitutional obligation to accede to the demands of this movement. Now, this movement is demanding inclusion of certain categories of employees in the pension redress. And even though not so explicit, it implies the reopening of the pension redress. The petition identifies basically three categories for inclusion, which is former employees who were discriminated with respect to pension but were no longer employed in the public service on the 2nd of September 1998, and employees who were eligible for the pension redress but missed the closing date. Then there were also those employees who were not aware of the pension redress and did not apply. Right. Coming to the introduction, during the apartheid era, South Africa, as we all know, was divided along racial lines and discriminated against blacks, colors, and Indians. And certain categories of black, colored, and Indian public servants were not allowed to contribute to the pension fund and had to wait before becoming permanent members of the pension fund. Now, this means that their full pensionable service was not recognized. Even though they've rendered a service, it was not recognized. Now, as part of the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council's contribution to government's broad objectives on restitution and transformation, the PFCBC embarked on the implementation of the pension redress to public servants who fall within the scope of the council and those who suffered various discrimination. This is just the legal framework applicable to... I'm not going to touch on the on all of that. It's the Labor Relations Act, the Public Service Act.
PSC one, the financial commission, that one. If somebody can manage to get that one.
PFCPC resolutions, as well as the government employees pension law. Now, this is just the overview of the pension redress program. I've already covered the pension discrimination pre-1994, and then I will quickly touch on the resolutions, the establishment of the structure, the closeout program, the verification, the agreement on reduction factor, as well as the legal opinion. Now, parties to the PSCBC agreed and signed Resolution 7 to recognize this non-contributory service as pensionable service within the government employees' pension fund. And then Resolution 7 provided that the funding of such redress will be derived from 1% reduction in the funding level of TEPS. Now, the funding level is basically the financial position of GEPF expressed in terms of its assets, reserves, and liabilities. The limit was 1% of the funding level of GEPF at the time. And then later on, parties also agreed to sign Resolution 12 of 2002 to include those other employees who participated in industrial strikes and were later reinstated or re-employed in terms of the strike settlements reached by their respective departments and trade unions, the non-statutory forces and general assistants who were formerly employed as casual workers. Now, as I've already indicated, that the first resolution of 1999 placed a limit on the reduction factor. So the amount that was ring-fenced for this purpose was 6 billion, and it was put in a reserve account. But then over the time, it accumulated interest and stood at about 8.7 billion as of the 30th of June 2018. And the implementation of the pension redress commenced on the 29th of November 2002 for applications and closed on the 31st of July 2012. Now, this period of 10 years afforded maximum opportunity for potential beneficiaries to apply for the pension redress. And then the legislative limit in terms of the period for eligibility is that only those employees who were in service as at the 2nd of 1998 were eligible to apply for the pension redress. So this is one of the reasons why this movement is demanding the inclusion of certain categories. And those employees who were not employed as at the 2nd of September 1998 were not eligible to apply. Now, this is the qualifying criteria as set out in the resolution. There were those employees who were discriminated on the basis of race, gender, or status of employment. There were also the strikers, which were mentioned in the second resolution of 2002, and other various categories of discriminatory practices where people... employees were not admitted to pension funds, to permanent ones, but only temporary pension funds due to their physical or medical status. I'm not going to go through the various employees because they are mentioned in the resolution. There were also South African police members who were dismissed in 1990, the CISCI strikers, employees dismissed in the Transvaal Provincial Administration and KZN, and also those who were students and were denied membership of government pension funds based on the status of their employment, for especially those who were appointed in terms of fixed term contracts, like a student nurses. Then the PSCBC established task teams to communicate the pension redress. What they did, firstly, they conducted workshops throughout the country explaining the qualifying criteria, where and how the application forms should be submitted. And this was communicated through radio stations in vernacular, print media, and pamphlets, which were distributed. Now, GEPF was responsible for creating and distributing the application forms. When the task teams were established, they were both national and provincial task teams. The provincial task teams comprised of officials from the Office of the Premier who were responsible for collecting application forms from the respective departments, as well as people who have already exited. And then there were also applications. These applications were taken and sent to the PSCBC National Task Team. Now, the PSCBC National Task Team collated and tallied all the applications that were received and submitted them to the Government Pensions Administration Agency, because GPAA has got the system to process their applications. I'm not going to go through the phases of the pension redress, save to say that there was the pre-verification process and the costing by the actuaries and the recognition of the approved applications. What I would like to mention that under the costing of actuaries, it was only those applications that qualified and those who had outstanding information that were costed. The rest that did not meet the qualifying criteria were not considered for costing of this exercise. Now, as in September 2013, PSCBC received a total of 150,444 applications, and these were delivered to GPAA. GPAA provided reports to the PSCBC on the status of the verification process. The PSCBC resolved that an independent audit be conducted to verify whether the process followed by the GPAA was complete, fair, and accurate. There were some delays because some of the applicants submitted more than one application form just to make sure that their forms are in, and they applied for more than one period of discrimination using one application form, which also compounded the problems that GPAA encountered. GPAA made sure that all the applicants were notified of their applications. Whether you have been successful or not, everybody was notified. In June 2017, the PSCBC again appointed independent actuaries now to conclude the actuarial exercise. It must be borne in mind that the resolution of 1998 limited the funding to 1% of the funding level, which I've already touched. At the time, it was 6 billion. But then it accrued interest over the period to a total of 8.7 billion. The reports by the independent actuaries indicated that a total amount that was needed to fund the pension redress was 12.7 billion. Clearly, this means that there was a shortfall because what was available in the kitty was 8.7 billion. It was then decided that Resolution 2 of 28 should be concluded to address this issue of the shortfall. And there was a reduction factor of 68.4%, which related to all qualifying applicants now receiving 68.4 cents in the rand, or 64.4% of the period recognized. Because there was a shortfall, nobody could now get 100%. The implementation process continued. GPA started paying now the qualifying applicants in April 2019. The challenges that they encountered during the process, the implementation process, was that some of the qualifying applicants had since passed on, and then they had to open estate accounts. And some of them didn't even nominate beneficiaries. Some of them changed their addresses and bank accounts, which also delayed the whole process of payment. Some of them had tax affairs that were not in order, and SARS doesn't issue a tax directive if your tax affairs are not in order, so you will not get your payment. There was also the long-drawn post office strike that caused delays for certain applicants in receiving the correspondence. I think I need to mention at this point that those employees, those applicants who had outstanding information were given a further 6 months to go collect the outstanding information. But then there was the long post office strike, and it also delayed them sending the outstanding information to GTAA. There were also people who were taking their chances, the con artists that were selling the application forms created by GEPF to desperate pensioners. And of course, these were not accepted because they were not legit. Now, the final costing of the pension redress formed the basis of the conclusion of Resolution 2 of 2018. And by then, we had about, out of the 150,000 applications that were received, it was found that 72,000 consisted of approved ones, which is 53,717. And then the error cases were those that had outstanding information. These are the ones that I said they were given a further 6 months to go get the outstanding information and submit to GEPF in order to qualify or not to qualify. Now, of the 53,000 approved qualifying claimants, GPAA categorized them into four different groups: those who were still in service at the time of payment, those who were in receipt of pension, meaning that those who are now pensioners. And then there were also those who exited the fund but were not receiving the annuities like your normal pensioners, but they received a once-off gratuity. And then there were also those of the estate of deceased claimants. This is the breakdown that we received from GPAA as at the 5th of February. Members were still in service. Let me put it this way, that the total of the total number of applicants that had since received their monies or increased their pension services is 54,217, which is 93% of the total applicants. The process is still ongoing, and GPAA anticipates that they will complete the process by end of March 2022. But the applicants are regularly informed of the progress. This is the petition, the response that we received from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor regarding the petition from the movement. I would like to mention first that the movement contends that the exclusion of the former employees is unconstitutional in terms of Section 9 of the Constitution, as it unfairly discriminates against previously disadvantaged government employees who suffered the same unfair discrimination. They claim that the people who were not in service at September 2nd, 1998, also suffered the same unfair discrimination. And the same Section 9 of the Constitution provides that everyone is equal before the law and has the right to equal protection and benefit of the law. So the legal opinion then quotes a Concord case of Sithole and another, versus Sithole and another, that the principle of equality does not require everyone to be treated the same, but simply that people in the same position be treated the same. It is also an accepted principle that the state may differentiate between persons if there are legitimate reasons for such differentiation. Now, the way the legal opinion was given was such that if the movement is focusing, their focus is on the collective agreement, then the legal advice is that collective agreements are binding in nature. They are binding on the parties to the agreement. Now, the parties to the agreement are the employees represented by their trade unions and the employer, and not former employees. So they are not part of the collective agreement. And the parties to the collective agreement were duly authorized. Therefore, it means that under no legal or any constitutional obligation to amend the agreement to provide for, to accede to the demands of this pension group. Now, I mentioned that they wanted also exclusion of those employees who missed the closing date. And it was well explained that the employees were afforded enough time. There was ample time that was given because the pay started in 2002 and the closing date was 31 July 2012. So that afforded potential applicants ample time to apply. And even those who had applied who had outstanding information were given a further 6 months to submit all their outstanding documents. And the PSCBC and GPAA and GPSA conducted workshops throughout the country explaining the qualifying criteria, how and where the application forms should be submitted. Now, the legal opinion says that if the movement decides to go the constitutional route, then also the constitution, it has clarified that, sorry, the constitutional court, not the constitution, has clarified the process to be followed, that one must first determine whether the relevant legislation applies, and only if it is found wanting does one turn to the constitutional provision. And as I've already indicated, the former employees were not part of the resolution because it is an agreement between employees and employers. I will pause here. Thank you.
Thank you. We now open presentation for discussion by the meeting. Those who want to take a bite, I can see Honorable McClure, Honorable Mutsipe, Honorable Kibi, Honorable Ntuli, in that order. Honorable McClure.
Thank you so much, Chair, and my apologies for not having my video on. Chairperson, I want to thank the presenter for this presentation. Secondly, one have to note that this is quite very long outstanding. In terms of the process, I just need some clarity. There was a petition. It has been dealt with the relevant structures. But now before us, I don't know whether this is in for information or also for a stance or decision to take, taking into consideration also the various factors pertaining to the constitutional requirements. Then secondly, Chair, what I cannot understand, I think that the presentation and the recommendation to a certain extent is a little bit harsh in terms of the time frame and closing dates. I'm going to say why I'm saying this. It has been stated that for quite a while, they struggled to get hold of people due to change of addresses, change of telephone numbers, change of accounts, as well. So I'm not too sure whether it will be written in stone that some of these employees would then not qualify. Also pertaining to perhaps, if I may use the word, a list of former employees within the public sector. Has everything been done to get hold of those individuals? You know, on the floor, among some of people that has been within this public service, I can tell, you know, last year when this petition surfaced and has been asked for a little bit of a chance for the minister to go through it, there is also a quite, where I come from, a quite a number of teachers, if I may use this word, that is not aware of what is transpiring in all of this. And I am concerned. I am someone for time frames. It is important to have time frames, but the department must really be honest and tell us whether the 22nd of March will really be a date that they will make up and come up with a solution as far as all of this is concerned. Then my last concern or question, Chair, should the civil servants go the constitutional route, which may be a court, I would want the department to also tell us, or the legal side of it, whether the department will be ready for such action. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable McClure. Honourable Mutsipe.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. And I would like to apologize for not showing my video due to network problems. And I would also like to welcome the presentation on the pension redress. I've got I'm asking for clarity here on this pension redress. In 1992, there were illegal industrial strike. The public servants, by then it was TPA. The employees participated in the industrial strike, and later they've been reinstated. And then, which was then the TPA, as I said, and they forfeited all their benefits, and they started from the beginning. All their services were started from the beginning, and later they were called to fill in the forms in order to get what was due to them. Till to date, nothing was happened, and then most of them, they died. And then where does this category of the employees fall in terms of the pension redress program? Because so far, no one has got the knowledge of what is happening and what was happened, as then the process is ending now in March. So because no one was called, and then since they have filled in the forms for getting their benefits. So I just want to know, where does these people who participated in the industrial strike for 1992 falls? Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Kibi.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My apologies for not putting on the video because of the network. Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair, and honorable members, and everybody, the colleagues. Honorable Chair, let me also welcome the presentation by the presenter this morning. Honorable Chair, one is quite happy that now at the ultimate end with this report after quite a long time, but I understand it was because the department did not want to make any mistakes, wanted to be sure about whatever that they are doing, and also during the process of getting a legal advice and the direction in terms of the redress issue. But what I want to get in by the end of March, do you think that period will be enough for you, your deadline? Is it enough for you to do everything that you are supposed to be doing? And the other thing, do you still have in your system, do you still have the people that did not apply, that do you still have the records of everybody that was there, even those that you tried to contact but could not get hold of them? And also my other one is based on the legal advice that you have and the opinion, is there not, are we not going to run a risk where people are going to challenge this process legally? That's my take, Honorable Chair. Thank you.
You, Honorable Nduli.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can I also not show my video, Chair, with your permission? Chairperson, I've been covered. Well, firstly, Chairperson, is welcoming this very crucial presentation. It's very crucial. You see, Chair, this is the democratic dispensation. We are under the democratic dispensation government. I think it's quite correct for this government to correct the disadvantages of the past. And Chairperson, in terms of the exclusion and in terms of the criteria, I think I understood for those who were taking chances, really they were supposed to be eliminated. But in the totality and realistically, whether you were still in the system, if you went out of the system without being paid, that means you were discriminated. It was very crucial to relook on the people that were no longer in the system when you took the resolution, because they went out without the pay. And this government is reversing the disadvantages of the past. So for me, I do agree with this group to say they are supposed to be inclusive. That is one. My two is, let's thank the department of that extension of 6 months for the people to find themselves, to whether you missed or what. But I wanted to check as to what will happen to the deceased. Will their families benefit? Because if my family, if my father worked for the public service, and he up to the end of his life not benefiting, that means his benefit, my father or my mother or whoever, the benefit should not die with the people. The benefit should be left behind for the families to benefit.
I wanted to check as to is whether is there any arrangement in this regard. And Gibby covered me in terms of the legal opinion to say, in most cases, we've seen a government losing cases at court. Do you think, as the department, this legal opinion is a cut and dry? Isn't maybe, does it have any loopholes? Is it going to cover DPSA in this regard? Yeah, thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Can we get the response now from the department?
Thank you, Chair. I will ask the police, NOMSA, to answer. Unfortunately, some of the details, I don't have it, as I was not in the department at the time, but NOMSA has done some research work on it. She'll cover that, and then I'll speak on the other broader principal issues that are coming through. Thank you. NOMSA?
Good morning. Good morning.
Oh, Odisha, sorry.
Smoothie says it
was surprised by the voice of this norms.
Odisha is the acting DPG. I thought he was not here because he had to go to bargaining council staff. I'm happy he's here.
Yes, I will be going there after this presentation, DG. Thanks. And thanks, Chair, and thanks to the members of the committee on the reception of the presentation. I would like to start with the tracking eligible employees, former employees who qualify. That we are indicating in the presentation that following the submission of their forms, there are instances where it was discovered that some of them then changed the addresses and they could not be traced back to the address that they had submitted in the form and the contact details and so on. And a tracing process then has ensued, and some of them were found and payments done accordingly. And there are those then who had passed on before their forms could be processed, and so whatever proceeds must go into their estate, the pensions administration is helping to assist to see to it that the families receive those proceeds, as it were. So those who qualified and would have passed on, unfortunately, before they got paid, the proceeds will go to the estate, which is their families. On the strikers, we are reflecting in the report that the TPA strikers as well, the CISK strikers and other strikers would have been dismissed and reinstated. The redress covered them. And it's in the presentation, Chairperson. On possible litigation, we are confident that following the case law that is mentioned even in the opinion, that the department is on good ground, on solid ground legally. And again, any organization that has got a problem with the KCDC resolution actually must then challenge the KCDC as an institution, because this is an agreement of the parties at the level of the council. Therefore, in whatever process, litigation process, the KCDC would have to be one of the respondents, if not the first respondent, actually, as this agreement would be the agreement of the council. So we have that confidence that the department can be able to defend any litigation that can ensue from this particular process. And I think those are the questions that I would like to respond to, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just before NAMSA responds, I understand that we have colleagues from JIPA who are actually implementing responsible for administration of the pensions and implementing all these things we're talking about. I don't know if the colleagues would want to take some of the questions and answer directly.
They are free to do so if they want. They must just shout.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Jay Morar. I'm calling. I'm speaking on behalf of the administration. Can I go ahead and communicate, Chair?
Yes, you can.
Thank you, Chair. So I think my colleague from DPSA has mentioned the issue around the TPA and other strikers, and that information is available in the presentation. As far as the processing of claims, the claimants that was asked early on, we had paid, as per the presentation, 93% of the claimants. And what is outstanding, in fact, is a small percentage, given the fact that we are unable to obtain certain information from the deceased members and or the and therefore we are trying other methods of how to obtain certain information from these members who have requested payment. We are using third-party data. We are using information such as the contact tracing organizations to help us to assist in providing information where we have deceased claimants. Chair, I thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there another person who wants to respond?
Chairperson, the cautions, about the fact that we may probably be litigated is actually noted, and just the sentiment that it feels like it is not correct for the matter not to be looked at again is actually also noted. And I will actually also probably look at what this says in terms of the Ubuntu principle of or spirit of the Constitution. I hear that Timothy says that the PSCBC might possibly be the first respondent if we are litigated. We need to know that, and maybe to a large extent also look at how we actually continue maybe involving in the discussions the PSCBC. But all these matters that have actually been put forward have been noted, and I think a lot of monitoring of this matter needs to actually take place. Thank you, Chairperson.
I see Honorable Mutsipe wants. Can I give Honorable Mutsipe to ask the question?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want precisely the answer that the 1992 employees, they fall in this category or not. I didn't get that, please. Thank you.
I hope that now noted.
Chair, I actually wanted to pick up that question and not responded and ask NAMSA if she has information on it. From my side, I would not be able to respond to it now. Would have to go back and check that information. But I also just wanted to say that I took up a discussion with the DG Treasury to check if there is any appetite to reopen the process. From a financial point of view, last year we had a meeting with the DG Treasurer on the matter, and the DG Treasurer at the time made it clear that there is no prospect to reopen a discussion on the matter to open for any people who are left out in the process because of the financial position that we find ourselves as a country. His view was that sufficient funds were allocated at the time by Treasury for the pension redress, and that process is over and is closed, and the decisions were taken at the level of the bargaining council. So whatever, if honourable members may want the matter to be revisited and opened up again, there is also that hurdle that we have to go through at a financial level, which is approval from Treasury. Thank you, Chair. I don't know if NOMSA has a response for the 1992 question. Otherwise, if not, we will have to go back and get more information and research on the matter.
Can you take the floor, NOMSA?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I will. If you look in the qualifying criteria, it is stated that the Wasiska strikers who striked in between 1990 and 1991, and there were also those from the TPA between 1991 and 1993. The Honorable Ms. Mutsepe, your 1992 illegal strikers were covered because we have TPA between 1991 and 1993. I suppose they did not apply, even though they fall into this category that did not apply. They were eligible to qualify, but they did not apply. Thank you.
Thank you, NOMSA.
Chairperson, maybe I missed it twice. They were responding for those who were no longer in the system as to what was their final case. Because my take was that if you were out of the system without pay, you were discriminated before you left, before leaving the system. What happened to that criteria?
Thank you. Department, can you come in and respond to that?
DG?
No, thanks. Thanks, Chair. The concern around the cut-off date is noted. However, the parties at the time in 1998, when they entered into the resolution, had come to some sort of time frame for the process in itself, and the PSCBC. Those who would have left before the establishment of the PSCBC, I think that the timing of the cut-off date as well coincides with the establishment of the PSCBC as an institution, as it were. But we take it also that there were also financial considerations that were taken even at the time to say, we are opening up for this particular period, and that's the period that the parties would have agreed to. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. I see Honorable McClaws and is up again.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. They always want to have a second bite at the cherry. There were no response on the target date for 22 March. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I would like to say this on behalf of the committee, that we appreciate the Deputy Minister's response with particular reference to Ubuntu principles. And we are taking note of that. And I think this should be our plea to reconsider for opening up and for the department to come here and to inform us that they will not reopen it with a reason stating that because of the financial state of this country. I think that's a low blow for us. there's no financial state or difficulties. We have a 6 million that has escalated or actually grown to 8 million rand. And that all that we are asking as members of this portfolio committee is to reconsider in the light of what the deputy minister has said in terms of reconsideration. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any response to that, department?
Jefferson, can I come in?
Yes, you can come in, TM.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks to Mr. McClure and the understanding of the response, but it's not really a commitment to reopening. It's just looking at matters that may actually be considered as we navigate forward in terms of revisiting this process that is actually being advocated for it being reopened. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. I see Oliswa's hand is also up.
Thank you, Chair. I was hoping to speak before the Deputy Minister, but I just wanted to clarify that there is no position of the Department of Public Service and Administration that says we're not going to reopen the matter because of financial implications. However, I was sharing information that came out of a meeting we had with Treasury. And of course, we rely, as DPSA, we rely on Treasury approval and indication of available resources to support this decision if we were to review and if we were to open for a review, because it does have financial implications. I just thought I wanted to clarify that we have not taken such a decision as department. However, we've been consulting different stakeholders, and one of the stakeholders is Treasury, and Treasury expressly indicated that there is no resources to be able to take this forward. However, this was in a meeting. If the committee is of the view that the process must be reopened as a recommendation, we will have to write back to Treasury formally so that Treasury engages with us formally on the matter. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Yolisa. Yeah, we have gone through now this presentation and all questions asked were answered sufficiently. TM, do you want to make an opening remark again before this next presentation, or was it covered sufficiently in your opening remark?
Thank you, Chairperson. No, it wasn't actually covered. We only covered the one on pension retreats. For now, we're going to be looking at the state of readiness to conduct lifestyle audits in the public service. In the year 2022 State of the Nation Address, President Ramaphosa reiterated that government is taking decisive steps to expose and punish corrupt activities and to restore professional and effective public service. The Department of Public Service and Administration actively contributes towards this through initiatives aimed at professionalization, modernization, and optimization of public service. This is to build an ethical public service, which includes the adoption of lifestyle audits as an anti-corruption risk management tool. On the 1st of April 2021, Minister for Public Service and Administration approved a guide to implement lifestyle audits in public service. This compelled national and provincial departments to conduct lifestyle audits as part of a continuous risk management process. Lifestyle audits have to be conducted every year for senior management service members and every second year for non-senior management service members. It is therefore a continuous process. The Public Administration Ethics, Integrity and Disciplinary Technical Task Unit, called DAWU, provided implementation support to ethics officers to ensure departments implement the guide. I want to inform the committee that the Public Service is ready to continue with lifestyle audits, and that the unit will continue supporting departments, but also to monitor and assess the effectiveness of the process and to improve the process as we continue, Chairperson. I'm going to request the Director General to proceed with the presentation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Take the floor, DG.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to immediately hand over to Dr. Solomon, who is the head of the Technical Advisory Unit that's running with the lifestyle audit. Thank you.
You can take the floor. I was asked to give a presentation on the state of readiness to conduct lifestyle audits in the public service. Just want to see why it's not moving. Yeah. Are you muted, Dr.? Sorry, Chair, I was struggling to get the button to move forward because it also whites the screen, but now I found it. Thanks, Chair. I was supposed to provide the Portfolio Committee with a state of readiness to conduct lifestyle audits in the public service. I will have nine issues that I will address. Maybe to start at the beginning, lifestyle audits are the legal framework work for that stems from the Constitution, Section 195, that requires that all public servants must maintain and adhere a high level of professional ethics. Now, this is fed into Section 3H of the Public Service Act that provides the Minister for the Public Service and Administration to establish norms and standards relating to integrity, ethics, conduct, and anti-corruption. And this is carried through to Regulation 22 of the Public Service Regulations that provides for a head of a department to analyze ethics and corruption risks as part of that department's system of risk management and to develop and maintain an ethics management strategy that prevents and deters unethical conduct and acts of corruption. Now, this is exactly the reason why lifestyle audits is seen as a risk management tool to detect corruption and unethical conduct. And this is what the guide to implement lifestyle audits is about, to outline the process implemented or the process adopted to implement lifestyle audits. Now, lifestyle audits is a decentralized process, meaning that it's the responsibility of the departments to implement lifestyle audits following the guide. The lifestyle audits were divided into three steps, which the first one is the review process, where there's focus on reviewing the data that's submitted through the e-disclosure system, and that's done by the ethics officers in the different departments. Then if they detect something that looks like criminality or if there's unethical conduct and so that require investigation, that is then referred internally to the investigators to assess if there's conclusive evidence of that. And if it's found, then it's moved to the SATs, specifically the DPCI, who has units created to look at public servants and public administration officials that is involved in corruption. And then in a few cases where the case is so complex that it cannot be resolved internally, auditors will be then outsourced to take the process forward. And in this process, the Public Administration Ethics, Integrity and Disciplinary Technical Assistance Unit, or TAL, is responsible to provide technical assistance in terms of the Public Administration Management Act, but also to strengthen oversight on the process to see that it's implemented and where there's systemic weaknesses to intervene. Now, as I've indicated, there's three processes: the lifestyle review, the lifestyle investigation, and the lifestyle audit.
the three together makes up the concept lifestyle audit. You can't go to a lifestyle audit if you did not start at step one, which is the lifestyle review. And then from there, you progress to lifestyle investigations if there's sufficient information. And only in those cases that's complex, as I've indicated, will they move to lifestyle audit. Now, this is to make it more manageable, but also to break it up into different skills group where there's responsibilities for people already allocated in terms of the legislation, so that one can then train those people properly, and then they can also, we can build the skills and expertise incrementally. And it also lessens the burden on designated officers and departments, and it builds in good governance principles, so that the lifestyle audit process cannot become a witch hunt process where people are being targeted and it's not part of a risk management process. So we have undertook four steps to implement the strategy. The first one is where we prepared from 2018 to 2020 the frameworks to prepare the legislative framework. And compulsory to disclose their financial information, but also to roll out the system so that it covers all the business in the public service. Now, in terms of the second step, and that is the step that we're currently at, is to focus on strengthening the first phase of lifestyle audits, and that is the lifestyle reviews. This is the most critical part, where we need to focus on the validation of information, also correcting information on the different databases that is not correct, the detection of conflicts of interest, and also to detect unexplained wealth, which is the why we are doing lifestyle audits. So in this step, we are training currently the ethics officers. I will come back to that at a later stage in the presentation. But we are also planning on training the investigators to know what to look for, so that we can strengthen the lifestyle investigation process, so that we can have proper referrals for lifestyle audits. Now, the third phase was for us to strengthen our electronic disclosure system. Now, this system is the system that public servants use to disclose their financial interests as is required in terms of the public service regulations. And this information is now up to date from level 9 to level 16, but it also includes all the OSD levels, it includes all ethics officers, it includes the information of all supply chain managers, and also all the information of financial managers and people involved in the financial sphere, because that is typically high risk areas. Now, the DPSA also buys data that we share with the departments to minimize costs, so that they can link into our e-disclosure system and they can then verify the information submitted by the employees. And we're also busy with the process to automate the system so that it can automatically red flag where there is issues detected. Now, the fourth phase is where we are, and we're currently also busy with the legislative amendment to introduce lifestyle audits pertinently as a concept in the public administration, which means that it will cover then the local government as well. And for that, we need the PALMA regulations to be adopted. The last step then, after the work that we've been doing now under phase one to phase four, which we are busy with, this current financial year, and some that would spill over to the next financial, next year, not the next financial year, is then we will follow that up with step four from 2023-24, where we will roll out this, what we've learned and what we've encountered in the public service as a pilot, to roll that out to municipalities. First, this year already, we will start looking at the assessment of the situation, because we must look at systems, people, access to systems, how they capture data, the format, also how people are appointed, the different ways to verify the information, and also reporting structures. Now, Going to the implementation support, as I've indicated in the beginning and the Deputy Minister alluded to, the TAO is responsible for implementation support, and this we synchronized with the disclosure period. April, SMS members are required to disclose their financial information on the e-disclosure system, so we targeted our implementation support for after April, so that we can then assist the ethics officers in looking at SMEs members. And then June, July, when the other categories capture the information, thereafter we focused on training the ethics officers to look at those categories, because they couldn't start before April if there's no information on the system. The e-disclosure information is the starting point for lifestyle reviews. So you will see, I'm flagging here the awareness sessions that we did for the National Prosecuting Authority. We also had a session with our own unit to make sure that everyone is on board and understand what we require and want from the implementation. Then we had the Office of the Premier for KwaZulu-Natal. Then the 13th of 14th July, we targeted all the provinces to create awareness around the guide, what is expected. That we covered all the provinces, and the 15th we also then targeted national departments and components for specific awareness on the guide that is required for implementation. Now, targeted training was where we moved more than only creating awareness around the guide, but started to look at how do you implement the guide and look at lifestyle reviews. So you will see in November we conducted sessions with the Office of the Premier in Limpopo, Free State Provincial Treasury, KwaZulu-Natal Office of the Premier, Mpumalanga Office of the Premier, which coincided with the ethics seminar they had. In November we also did the Gauteng Department of Human Settlements. And then December, the Civilian Secretariat for the Police, January Office of the Chief Justice, and in February, the Department of Arts and Culture. Now, we also performed some specialist training, and that is where we got assistance from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, who is also responsible for South Africa's G20 work, especially to help us in execution of the United Nations Convention Against Corruption. And they have significant experience in verification of financial disclosures, where they've put us in touch with international experts, and with their assistance and that of the World Bank, we managed to train 42 ethics officers at the beginning of May last year. But we also did training this year, the 14th of February, and this is the same training that we are earmarked this Friday when we have our lifestyle audit in Durban. For ethics officers and stakeholders to explain and also to have a debate around the implementation of this guide. Now, after we did all the training and awareness and we had sessions with a different department, we in October last year distributed the circular where we requested the departments to provide us feedback on the progress that they are making to implement lifestyle audits. And that feedback we required by the 31st of January 2022. The information we received back after January was that 16 national departments provided the information and 6 of the 9 provinces provided the information. Now, this information is a bit different when we assessed yesterday and we did some follow-up. It's now 18 national departments and 7 of the 9 provinces provided feedback that was at the time of submitting the presentation. Now, the national departments that provided feedback, you will see it's flagged on the screen. I just want to highlight that the National School of Government, the Office of the Public Service Commission, and the DPSA also they also provided their inputs in terms of lifestyle audits, indicating that it was successfully completed. Now, the province then did not provide feedback at the stage when I drafted the presentation or to Mpopo and Mpumalanga and the Free State. In the meantime, Mpumalanga also started to perform lifestyle audits. Now, the national departments, you will see, I flagged it per the province. In the northern northwest, you will see that the only department indicating that they were still in the process of conducting lifestyle audits was the Department of Health. The Northern Cape, a number of departments participated in the process. The Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development indicated that the SMEs were completed and the rest are in progress. And the Western Cape also indicated progress. And then also there was a request at that time of the Mpumalanga Health to extend the request for obtaining information to the end of March 2022. Now, what we found when we analyzed the information...
Is not available at present. Please try again later.
So what we found when we looked at the information was that most of the departments really performed proper lifestyle reviews, which is a very important step, as I've explained in the beginning, in the whole lifestyle audit process, because you can't move to the next phase if you did not do a proper. So the Western Cape indicated that they already progressed to the second phase, which is investigation, which we did not envisage already in this stage, where the Department of Health, Provincial Department of Health, Western Cape, referred 743 non-SMS members for investigations. The investigations referred is not necessarily because they detected crime, it's because they detected anomalies that needs to be looked at, mostly in terms of the non-disclosure of assets, vehicles and companies. And also the Provincial Treasury of the Western Cape referred three SMEs members, where one case is that for possible conflict of interest, and two where employees possibly are conducting or performing other remunerative work without permission. And of course, these may also be linked to criminal activity where there's the employees conducting business with the state, and that is now being investigated. So in all, our finding is that the process this far had a very positive impact on the management of conflicts of interest in departments, which not only stops corruption, but it also stops unethical behavior, and it also reinforces ethical conduct. So in that sense, where it strengthens, it also made departments think of how they capture the information, and also to verify the information submitted by the various public servants, so that it's not just a tick box exercise and we say that information is captured. Now it's verified against the training to make sure that that information is analyzed to see whether it points to people earning extra income that is not clear where it comes from, or unexplained wealth and so forth. So this indicates to us that the basis for lifestyle audits, which is lifestyle reviews, is actually performed properly. Now, the challenges that we identify during this process is that ethics officers are designated and not appointed. That means that the task, and it doesn't happen everywhere and frequently, but it may happen that ethics officer is yearly rotated because it's an HR official and being allocated different work. And that makes training especially very difficult because we need to then retrain every year. But we will mitigate that risk by we procured a training system that we will implement later this new financial year in 4 months' time, where training will be available online and that ethics officers can go through that to retrain themselves. And of course, we will also provide the necessary support. Then we also detected halfway through the monitoring process that there's a lack of knowledge among the ethics officers to determine when employees are actually living beyond their means. I will also come back to the litigation in terms of that. So as a way forward, over the long term, we as the DPSA and TAL are looking at how to professionalize the role of the ethics officer and to consider to appoint ethics officers instead of designating them. Of course, this will not be a quick thing. It won't be easy because we also need to look at the wage bill and to manage that it doesn't become a financial burden, but that we also can prove that the role of ethics officer also assists with mitigating corruption where we as government lose money. Also, the second part is that we need to continuously provide targeted support and training to the ethics officers, and not only based on what we think they need, but that we need to do proper skills audits and a needs assessment, which we started with the ACIP project under the Canadian government funding, where they are doing surveys, finalizing surveys to for us to assess the level of skill and the needs that we would require of ethics officers to be addressed. Then also, in the interim, when we found that the ethics officers doesn't really know where when a person is living beyond his or her means, we distributed the salary band of ethics, the government employees to ethics officers, and also explaining and training how to use that to determine then if a person has certain properties. If you look at that, it cannot really be bought by the taking into consideration the person's salary band. And then also, of course, we address that, as I've indicated, through the risk-based verification of financial disclosures training. Now, the other way forward is for us as the TAL to look at automating processes to make it easier for ethics officers and departments, but also to make sure that human error doesn't come in, but also to make sure that there's no selection of people and persons based on preferences, but that it's an automatic process so that it's risk-driven, looking at the risk categories that we need to be concerned about. So we're starting to conceptualize the automation of the e-disclosure system, where it will flag the employees living beyond their means. Here we are supported by the Financial Intelligence Center and the South African State Security Agency, who are assisting us with getting categories, risk categories and categories, because it's also work that they have done in their respective fields as well. And then also using an electronic platform to upload training material, as I've alluded to earlier, where we're in the process of finalizing the procurement of the Moodle system. That will be a communication tool and also an awareness tool for ethics officers, where we will upload training and content for ethics officers to have a look at. But of course, this will be supplemented by more formal courses that will be that we will engage the National School of Government with to host on these systems. So the main thing as a way forward is that the TAL need to address the monitoring capacity, and in that sense we already advertised the position as a deputy director that would be responsible for monitoring, amongst others, the implementation of lifestyle audits, so that we, on a monthly basis, can start monitoring the implementation of lifestyle audits, so that we can preemptively address issues before it becomes crisis. Now, Chair, I want to conclude to say that although it looks like it's a small number of government employees or departments that report it, 18 currently as it stands, out of the 42, it's almost half of it. And by monitoring the process itself, we are happy that the three-step lifestyle audit process is working. But of course, there's room for improvement. And as skills improve in the ethics officers and also the investigators, and the process becomes normalized, lifestyle audits will improve and it will become more rigorous. And as indicated by the Deputy Minister, it's not a once-off process where we will now do lifestyle audits and then that's it, it's done. It's a process that will continue over time. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think you have a proper plan. I welcome your plan. Can I give Honorable Ntuli, Honorable Mugweba, Honorable Gondwe, Honorable Mutsipe in that order?
Thank you, Chair. And Chair, please pardon my meeting. Thank you, Chair. We welcome the presentation, Chair, and the meeting. This issue of lifestyle audit is there for quite some time, and by now we should have cleared and having a proper plan as the department has presented to us. But for me, there are still gaps. If you are still saying review, audit, investigation, we should be now have way done away with investigation way back. Chair, in terms of a DPSA, I think they should DPSA should be in a position to tell us as to what do they investigate as their own disciplinary measures to the department, not to people, to the department who are still left behind, and also the provinces. Because you can't tell us that, come today and tell us that province A is still doing this, province B is still doing that. There should be a time frame for everyone that we know that if it's March, from March to this time, we've got this process and that's all. By the way, this is the public service that is set to service the public of South Africa. This department should be looking as to how far is the service delivery on the ground, other than looking after employees. Let's have something. Just tell us if you have something, or if you intend devising something that is talking direct to the department and provinces. What is your measures that you put down? What are penalties that are there? Because you can't just come there as fire extinguishers. You can't keep on waking people up to say, wake up now, it's time for wake up. They must know what to do, when and how. I want to applaud this issue of
the changing or rotation of the ethics officers. I think that one can the meeting we should be with having a policy, not to say this department or that province, a policy that we don't keep ethics officers, and we'll be sitting on this with training of ethics officers yearly, and we know that we are going to train them. But again, we should be not maybe worrying about levels. We must know that only this level that is supposed to be in this office, not to say if you come to this office you are supposed to get a new level. No, on that one we shouldn't be worrying about it. But again, Chairperson, I think the department has done a lot of work. There is a work in progress here, but there are gaps. Just have a framework, some frameworks whereby you say you don't go beyond here, and what is your penalty? And again, we must have a policy of not vetting certain levels only. But if we are coming to public service, there must be vetting. There must be vetting, compulsory vetting for anyone coming, joining the family, that we know that this one has joined this family to work. We are not going to look after this one as public service should not be a grazing field whereby we are looking after people. People must work for the entire nation. We are looking at this public service to be a world-class public service. And if we are still dealing with individuals, when are we going to reach that one? And Chair, I think the presentation talked about other provinces outstanding. That's why I'm a bit worried to say, why do we have other provinces outstanding? Because they should know that we start from here and we stop from here. Chair, it was Limpopo, yeah. It was Limpopo, but they are still doing one, they are still doing two. And it's worse if we are still mentioning members. If we are still mentioning members for investigation. And in the public service, I think, Chairperson at the meeting, we should treat the public service as a Bible, a holy Bible. The holy Bible is saying a sin. The holy Bible is not saying there are small sins and bigger sins, just a sin. A sin is a sin. So we must treat it like that, so that people really come there prepared to work for the nation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Mkweba.
No, thank you very much, Chair. Can I close my video? The network in the village is very bad. Good morning, honorable members, the DM, and all colleagues. Chair, let me then welcome the presentation on the lifestyle audit. I've got only three questions for the department. One is on the slide that speaks to the implementation strategy. And there is a step four that speaks to the rollout to municipalities. Chair, my question to the department is that how are they going to monitor municipalities if the implementation strategy is a success or is being achieved? Or do they have a monitoring tool in this regard? As we know that, Chair, that our problems, our big problems in terms of unethical conduct and corruption are at municipalities mainly. That's the first question, Chair. The second one also is on the bullet three, also in the implementation strategy. The department have indicated of automate red flagging. Can the department explain further so that as the portfolio committee understands how does the system automate red flags against lifestyle? And the last question, Chair, we know that there is a slide on challenges where the department is saying the ethic officers are designated, but at the way forward, a slide where there's way forward, they also consider appointing ethics officers instead of being designated. Can the department then explain to the portfolio committee what will be the timeline to speedily prevent unethical conduct and acts of corruption? That is happening, in fact, in all levels of government. And it also delays the service delivery to the people of South Africa. Thank you very much, Chair.
Honorable Kondwe.
Yeah, let me also start by greeting everybody on the virtual platform and for welcoming the presentation from DPSA. I have a number of questions for the Department of Public Service and Administration. The first one is, in the background to the presentation, they make mention of the fact that Regulation 22 of the Public Service Regulations requires HODs to analyze ethics and corruption skills and to develop and maintain an ethics management strategy. Is the DPSA responsible for ensuring this, that this analysis is done by HODs and that the strategy is developed? Because I know, you know, the problem that we have sometimes in the public service is that we have all these things that need to be done, and there's no one really monitoring and ensuring that all these, you know, that the strategy is in place and the analysis is done. Because if, you know, you could have the analysis being done and the strategy being developed, I'm sure we wouldn't have a problem of ethics in the public service. So I just want to find out whether the DPSA has been active in terms of monitoring that, you know, HODs actually do this analysis and develop the strategies. And then I note that ethics officers were only trained in May 2021, which is a month after the adoption of the guide to implement lifestyle audits. And a month after the departments were informed that they have to start implementing these lifestyle audits, which was on 1 April 2021. One would have thought that the training of ethics officers would happen before, you know, the departments have to start implementing lifestyle audits. And that would explain why there's a lull in some of the departments, why there was no movement, because no one was actually trained by the time that, you know, the guidelines had been adopted and the departments were informed that they had to start implementing the lifestyle audit. And then coming back, I think Honorable McGregor has touched on the issue of ethics officers. I want to find out how are they chosen or selected for this particular role? Does seniority, experience, and you know, other factors come into play in terms of you know, choosing or designating people as ethics officers? And why can't directors of internal audit units within, you know, individual government departments take this responsibility of being ethics officers? Are they not better placed to actually, play this role? And then coming back to the issue of designation vis-a-vis, you know, appointment, what is the incentive for them to do this important job well and not treat it as an aside? Because the problem with them being designated and not being appointed is that, you know, if there's no incentive, there's really nothing that's pushing them to ensure that they do this job well, you know, and not treat it as something that, they do on the side. Now, the presentation indicates that Limpopo, Mpumalanga and the Free State did not provide feedback on the implementation of the lifestyle audit, and then Mpumalanga asked for an extension in terms of being able to, to implement these audits. I want to find out whether, you've had any communication from Limpopo and the Free State. Did you press them on why feedback was not forthcoming in this regard? And then, with respect to, I had a question around, but you touched upon it when you discussed the way forward. I was wondering whether you come up with recommendations, as the Department of Public Service and Administration around some of the challenges with the implementation of lifestyle audits. Especially this issue of appointment vis-a-vis designation. Have you made recommendations to departments in this regard, like formal recommendations? And then you touched on the fact that one of the challenges is the lack of knowledge. But I'm surprised that there's a lack of knowledge. Wasn't there training provided in May 2021? That doesn't really make sense. That is all from my end.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Yeah, on this presentation, I would like to know that does the public service have enough ethics officers to monitor lifestyles and conduct lifestyles audits? And then the second one is this lifestyle audit, will it include inheritance of like vehicles and houses or only finances or companies? And then the last one, I would like to reiterate this one, that my honorable member, Honorable Ntuli, has said that the provinces who did not provide feedback to or information on time, what will be the consequences? And then since they know what to do, what they must do, they must cooperate, what will be the consequences of that? Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Honorable Manel.
Thank you, Chair, and greetings to the committee member. Chairperson, let's also welcome the progress report.
Can we see you just for a few minutes? It is very important for the committee.
Okay, I'll just start my video now.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I switch it off now, Chair?
You can switch it off.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I was saying that really the concern that a small number of departments have reported progress. I think other committee members have emphasized on that as well. But however, Chair, I think I've got about two or three questions. My first question would be that these other remaining ethics officers that are to be trained, in terms of the schedule, we're given the start date of the training, but it's not clear as to when will the trainings be completed. If you can just be provided with that information, I think it will assist. Also emphasized by most members is the issue of the provinces that did not provide feedback, Chair. I was just leaving it like that. What must be the recourse for them not providing feedback? The investigations around Western Cape Municipal Department, are those investigations open-ended or are there timelines attached to those? And also, could we be provided with a progress report around those timelines? Chair, I think the last point that I would like to speak on is this one of ethics officers, them being designated, and also in my view support that we must professionalize these ethical officers for us to curb corruption. Because Chair and committee members, in some instances, you'll find those designated people or those designated ethical officers are in political offices. Probably if one will know that I'm an ethical officer and then this is what I'm supposed to do, will then have committed and dedicated people who will provide services and ensure that they provide on their services and deal with issue of tracking corruption. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I will now give the department an opportunity to respond to the questions asked, but let me make my comment before you respond. I want to record that I am finally happy that you are setting this process rolling of conducting a lifestyle audit, because we've been talking about this for a long time. At least now there is a roadmap. Please ensure that this roadmap is honored. Ensure that this system that you are establishing on lifestyle audit is catching anyone who is conducting business with the state illegally, and anyone who is living beyond his or her means. But I'm happy that now, finally, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Thank you very much, TM. I'm handing over to you and your team to respond to the questions asked.
Thank you, Chair. I'll ask the DG to respond to the questions. Thank you.
DG, take the platform.
Chair, I wonder if the DG did not leave. She indicated that around one she needs to be at another meeting.
That DG Mutisa?
Chair?
Who is the DG?
Chair, maybe because Dr. Salmon is the one that has actually made the presentation, can we ask him to respond to the questions?
Okay. Dr. Salmon can take the floor.
Thanks, Minister. Thanks, Chair. I think there's some issues that I can link together, where the one is around the issue of training. I want to emphasize that maybe in the report it does not, or in the presentation it does not come out clear. The training is scheduled around the times that the information becomes available on the system, so that the people can practically see the information and then work on that, but also sometimes just before that date, so that the training becomes relevant the moment that they need it. So, and this is not a once-off process, this will be continuous, where training will be conducted. In terms of the departments that did not comply, there was don't want to call it resistance, there was some issues around, is this a legal process, can we do it, how will we be protected, what will be the role of us? So there was a bit of hesitancy, and that's why we have the lifestyle audit in Durban tomorrow and the day thereafter as well, where we can allay fears and indicate to people it's just a practical tool to do risk assessment, aiming at also identifying corrupt individuals and those who are busy with unexplained wealth and those type of things. So we did follow up with the departments. We even trained OPO and the Free State on their request. And it looks like there's issues with capacity and organizing themselves. But we are working with them closely to make sure that we monitor progress, and those departments and provinces who are not compliant, we are within the regulations mandated to draft non-compliant letters to the department. Of course, our DG also follow up with their DGs. And then if need be, it can be escalated between the ministers, and there can even be disciplinary steps taken against those who do not comply. Also, like in the past, the portfolio committee that played a very crucial role when we started with employees conducting business with the state, can engage those provinces and call them and ask them why they do not comply. But this is, for me, currently premature, because we just started with the process. We see that there's a lot of goodwill, and I think working together and by following up, we can then later provide you with a big picture on who are the ones really that do not want to comply. Currently, I can't say there is no willingness. So I just want to thank the chair and the members as well for the encouraging work. Having the public service ready for lifestyle audits, it's not a day's work. It's not easy. There's a lot of complexities, things that one needs to consider. And I think having a plan puts us as government in a better space to move forward and to address the issues, and especially some of the concerns raised by Honourable Ntuli around gaps. That's why we are we split it in a three-pronged process, where the one spills over to the other one, but that we can also then look at the different phases, like review or investigation, audit, and identify if there's issues that we need to address very pertinently and quickly, like we have done Dr. Gondwe indicated something that doesn't make sense, where we train people before or after, and then found out that they didn't know how to do the unexplained wealth. It was in the first phases when we did the training, there was not a lot of emphasis on that. And when we realized that is a shortcoming, because we thought they would have known that. But that's why we went to the a drive to do needs analysis and look at what they want. And then we determined that we need to include that. And we retrained and looked in at that. And that would be the strategy going on. The moment that we find out that there's something that's not working, we will address and do continuous training in that regard. Honourable Mweba indicated the issue of rollout to municipalities, how we will monitor that. That would be under phase four, that would be for 2023-24. We are going to work closely with SALGA and COCTA, because we are not experts in the municipality sphere. We can help and assist with ethics and integrity, we are experts in that regard. But with their assistance, we will develop a monitoring tool to make sure that they are monitors. And I guess we will use the same strategy that we're currently using in terms of monitoring, where we request the departments to complete a template, and then we assess the template. We gave them in the template also the questions that we want, the statistics that we want, when they are doing investigations and when they need to report to us, but also details around what the phase of review entails. So it would take a similar stance. Then also the issue of ethics officers designated. It means that they are either HR specialists or risk specialists. And depending on the department, then they appoint as over and above work that person to also look at the ethics management. Most of the departments are moving now where they are actually having a full-time ethics office, and so the problem is starting to almost address itself, where departments see that they need a full-time ethics officer because it's a lot of work. So we have addressed the issue by requesting the departments not to change ethics officers, to keep the ethics officers and add even if they would like to, so that the work can be done. But that is, I think, where all of these questions around the ethics officers and the designation and that points to what we indicated in the report around challenges. We see it as a problem and we need to address it. And because government is in a tight fit with wage bills, we don't want to bloat further by saying appoint ethics officers, but we're busy doing the research and looking at how one can integrate that function without really a cost to government. Dr. Gondwe, I think some of the issues I did address. The one question you had is around Regulation 22 that requires that strategies be developed. Yes, this is monitored. The TAO has the mandate to look at how departments manage ethics. And the first step for any department in terms of ethics management is to do a thorough ethics risk assessment. We've also conducted a cultural ethics survey that ended the 18th of February across the three spheres of government, where we determined or requested the departmental employees to indicate the ethics risks in their specific areas. This was conducted by the Ethics Institute, and they are busy with a report, and that will feed into the strategies that the ethics office needs to drive and use for managing and working the ethics in the different departments. I think I've addressed the issue of why it was 1 month after and chosen, selected. I indicated that ethics officers are selected by the department. It's in terms of the regulation, where they are appointed, they are then designated. There is some requirement about who the person should be, and most of the time it's ethics, it's HR officials, or it is risk managers. We've decided against internal auditors because that will phase the, it will make the line for corporate governance blurred, because the ethics, the internal auditors are supposed to, at the end of the day, audit the whole process to make sure that the ethics officers towed the line and that the departments adhere to the ethics mitigation plan and so forth. So for that reason, the internal auditors should not be involved in any ethics management process. The incentives of the ethics officers, working with the ethics officers the past 10 years, being one myself at a previous stage of my life, most of this is done out of pure patriotism and for trying to correct and address issues in your immediate environment. So there's no other incentives. What we do have is ethics officer forums, where those ethics officers that did something exceptional, we acknowledge the work. We also request them to present their work and indicate and share their knowledge and experiences with others. So in that sense, we try to incentivize the departments. The lack of knowledge, I think I've addressed. We do make recommendations to departments and follow up to see that they do implement what we require. And as I stated in the beginning, we do have under Section 16A of the Public Service Act powers that the minister and can discipline, for example, HODs, and we can have non-compliance letters. So, Honourable Motsepe, you requested if we do have enough ethics officers. We have close to 400 ethics officers for each and every department. Most of the departments have more. The departments that is high risk, like one would say the SAPs, and not risk in terms of criminality, but because they are the defenders of the constitution, of democracy, those departments like SAPs, the NPA, SARS, the Hawks, police, so forth, they do have full-fledged ethics officers with a number of personnel, even more than TAO has, running management in their different departments. So we do have enough ethics officers. The issue of lifestyle audits, you asked if it includes inheritance and those. It does. Under the Public Service Regulations, Section 18, there's a whole host of information that is required to be disclosed, and that would include assets, movable, immovable, all those assets, and not only companies. So it gives a very broad picture on the employee's financial status. Okay, and I think the next one was also about the provinces. Then the last was the remaining ethics officers given a date of training. The training is ongoing. We started last year in May, when we just after we launched, to prepare them for when the information is captured on the system to be able to address that. And this is going to be ongoing. And that's why we also procured the Moodle system to allow us as the TAO to do this function, because we're also only 9 people in TAO in totality, and we need to work with technology to assist us with monitoring and evaluation. The investigations on Cape Town, it's not open-ended. The investigations, on all investigations that's opened, the departments will provide feedback on a regular basis to the TAL to track if they are following up with investigations, if there's action that happened, and if it progressed further to eventually a lifestyle audit and criminal investigations and so forth. That is information that we will keep on collecting from the department, and that would also put us in a position when we come and report at later stages, then we can report on that as well. Chair, I think that covers almost, I think, all the questions that's been asked. If there's one or two, I can maybe go back to that, but I've tried to answer as much as I can. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Now we are going to get a presentation by Public Service Commission on the financial misconduct. But before we get this, I will invite Professor Fikeni to make his opening address before the presentation is made. Thank you. I see you are already up, Professor Fikeni. Shoot, but don't shoot to kill.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee, for giving us this opportunity. I also recognize Deputy Minister Dr. Bilane Majake, as well as the colleagues from DPSA, the executive members there. And I am with the chairperson of the specialist team focusing on this particular area, that is Dr. Hank Borshoff, who is a commissioner. Also with me are fellow commissioners Yasmin Bakers and Commissioner Leonardo Horsen. We also have the DG Dingi Dube and the DDG Malachi, as well as the head of the unit on ethics, that is Ms. Mabua. This dovetails very well in terms of the presentation we just had on the lifestyle audit, because when we talk of presenting this report on the financial misconduct for the 2020-2021 financial year, it is an x-ray that exposes what kind of lungs or broken bones you have in your ribs, so that as the lifestyle audit begin to take effect, we will be doing the monitoring of that work and assisting the Portfolio Committee and Parliament at large to make sure that what is promised and what framework is there is adhered to. With that, I'll invite Commissioner Boshoff to lead in the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Professor Fikemi, Commissioner Boshoff, you can take the floor.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. Honourable Chairperson, you know, we present this overview report on financial misconduct to the Portfolio Committee on an annual basis. Data is collected from departments on a quarterly basis. We then consolidate a report, what we call an overview report, and that overview report is presented to the Portfolio Committee today for information, but also for guidance. Now, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act and the Treasury regulations, accounting officers are required to report on the outcome of completed disciplinary proceedings on financial misconduct to the Public Service Commission, among others. And they do this over the period that I've just explained. Now, what is important to note is that accounting officers report to the Commission on concluded disciplinary matters with regards to financial misconduct. In other words, not when they initiate the disciplinary process, they report to us once the process has been finalized. So we will present to the committee information on these completed disciplinary proceedings. We will also provide you with information on cases that have not been completed, and then we will provide you with a trends analysis starting from the 2017-2018 financial year up to the 2020-2021 financial year, the actual year of reporting, and provide you with as much information as possible. But Chairperson, we have always been concerned about the information we've been providing to the Portfolio Committee. Just to provide statistics on concluded cases for us wasn't sufficient. So since 2019, the Commission decided, but let us provide the Portfolio Committee with more information. Let us identify the amounts of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, unauthorized expenditure, irregular expenditure per department, and then request those departments to provide us with information on consequence management as well. So for us, and I mean we've listened to presentations this morning, the whole morning, it is extremely important that we see consequence management in the public service, and we will provide you with information with regards to that. We also, just this morning, received an email from our resident commissioner in KwaZulu-Natal, Commissioner Bakis, saying that the Premier of KwaZulu-Natal has also announced a consequence management framework in his State of the Province address. So provinces are starting to take this very seriously, and we will provide you with information. And then finally, Chairperson, we will also provide you with our observations. We are of the view that we are not there. Progress is being made to tackle consequence management, but we are not there yet, and we want to bring that to the attention of the Portfolio Committee as well. The comprehensive presentation on the overview report will be made by DDG Matome Malatsi, and he will be supported, as the Chair, Acting Chair of the Commission said, by the Director General Advocate Dinky Dube. Thank you very much, Chair. Mr. Malatsi will now make the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Malatsi. Take the floor. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and honorable members of your committee. As I'm loading the presentation, the basis has been laid for our presentation by both Professor Pikene as well as Commissioner Bosho. I will not repeat what they have said. I showed my picture just before I started so that my image can show. Honorable members know who is engaging with them. This is the presentation outline that we are going to engage with you. It has been said by Commissioner Bosho. I'm going to move straight away to slide number 4, where I'll deal with the last bullet as the others have been dealt with. We provide this information to this committee so that when the committee has got oversight visits and engagement with departments, you have information to hold these accounting officers accountable. We start off by indicating the departments that have submitted reports as required and those that have failed to submit the report. You will realize here 148 out of both national and provincial departments, 148 submitted, so that we can analyze and monitor what is happening and be able to report to you. However, there are 24 that have failed to submit. And of these 24 at national, we list them there. These are all national departments. But of these, corporate governance, health, home affairs, trade, industry and competition, as well as water and sanitation, these are repeat offenders. Then we have provinces that have not submitted. We reflect the relevant departments there. And the last one, Department of Education, is also a repeat offender there. There are reminders that we do send to departments through our DG's office. She will remind her colleagues that every quarter, this is the time, please submit your information. It's vital for the country to know what are you busy with. Are you taking action against financial misconduct? The slide shows now on the screen completed disciplinary proceedings for the 2020-2021 financial year. A total of 519 disciplinary proceedings were completed. And then we break it down in terms of national departments as well as provincial departments. I need to say that right away that when you look at this 519, it is a decline when you compare it to the previous years in completing disciplinary cases on financial misconduct. We will deal with that when we deal with the trends. Here, the slide reflects on the types. You will see that misappropriation leads the pack, followed by regular expenditure, gross negligence, fraud, in that order. Misappropriation accounts for the most cases,
this is where there is theft of money, there is a failure to bank revenue on regular basis, where officials will borrow themselves the money that they're supposed to bank, with the hope that when they get their salaries, will go and replenish, and they get caught in the process before that money gets replenished as required. I will pass on the slide. We still have more to say about the types. Here we reflect salary levels. You will note that salary levels 2 to 12 accounts for the most transgressions, which is at 47%, followed by levels 9 to 12, which this is level, we call it middle management. And the last level being 13 to 16, these are decision makers. These are senior management services members who are entrusted with the obligation to ensure that financial resources are managed effectively and efficiently. So it is important for this level to be included, to be visible where we reflect on completed disciplinary proceedings. They account for 10% of the completed disciplinary actions. When it comes to the outcomes now, which shows the impact, this is where the impact becomes visible, but more impact will go also into the mechanisms put in place by this department identified to prevent recurrence of similar transgressions. We have 98 officials found guilty, 85 not guilty, unfortunately 4 passed on, 1 contract has expired, 16 resigned, 8 retired, and 16 cases were withdrawn. Withdrawal will be where there is no evidence on which a successful disciplinary action can be taken. We show now on the sanctions for the period 2020-2021, final written warning accounts for the most sanctions. As you know, discipline is regarded as progressive in the public service. So you have, depending on the gravity of the transgression, start with counseling, final written warning, which in this case accounts for 61, followed by a combination. A combination will be where people are placed on suspension without pay, then they are also given a final written warning. Then you have dismissal accounts for 47. This is with respect to the most grievous financial misconduct that will be fraud, corruption, theft, even gross negligence will also be falling in this category. We have 29 that were suspended without pay. This suspension is a sanction. It's not a precautionary suspension, meaning you will not receive your salary for a period, not more than 3 months. Then there is a fine, verbal warning, counseling, and there will be demotion as well, for instance, from a director to deputy director, one level lower. When we reflect further on the sanctions, here we just want to indicate that of the 47 dismissal, 4 of them were members of the SMS, demotion, 3, 1 of them members of the SMS. In total, we have
18 SMS members that were sanctioned. And this is very critical for us to take account of the SMS, because this category is required to lead by example, to display the highest level of professional ethics and be a role exemplary to their subordinates. But also, with regard to their roles, Section 38 of the PFMA places a duty from the accounting officer and all the members of the SMS to make sure that financial misconduct doesn't happen. If it happens, the appropriate necessary action follows. We reflect here the total amount of money involved in the completed disciplinary proceedings. In other words, the 519 cases we are telling you about, how much money is involved, the total amount there is 945 million, just below a billion rand, you can say, and then we break it down in terms of national departments, which account for the most, followed by the provincial department. And we explain that the high amount by national department is as a result of the expenditure in the Department of Higher Education, which related to fraud and irregular expenditure, amounting to 181 million just in one department. And then you members will see that there is a breakdown in accordance with the provincial office. This slide will reflect on money that was recovered for the 2020-2021, and we indicate that 167,703,000 was recovered as at March 31st of March 2021. And then we also break it down to show that on the recovery, the provincial departments account for 404,000 rand, whilst the national department account for 167,199,000 rand. And we break it down per provinces as well as national. Here we reflect on money that may not be recovered for the period under review, and we indicate that a total of 632 million rand may not be recovered, and we provide a breakdown indicating that at national an amount of 982,000 rand may not be recovered, and at the provincial department we have 232 million rand that may not be recovered. And the reason provided by departments for no recoveries, the main reason is that services were rendered to the department, albeit through irregular supply chain processes. Now, this reason may be deceptive in the sense that the services that were rendered following an irregular process, you will find that a whole range of malfeasance is happening. For instance, inflation of prices and related maladministration, and we break it down per province, per national department, just as a way of reflection. Now we go on to reflect, as Commissioner Boshoff has indicated, disciplinary proceedings that are not completed. When you look at the completed ones, which is 519, one may think that there is a deadline, but when you see there are 319 disciplinary proceedings which were reported as not completed and the breakdown is provided, then one will realize that no, there is a high number of disciplinary cases that fall in this category of financial misconduct. It's just that the 319 were not completed, and many reasons are provided for non-completion. We provide a list here where disciplinary hearings are pending, postponed, or in progress. Investigation is still also ongoing, awaiting approval to initiate investigation. Awaiting appointment of presiding officer, awaiting appointment in case of the defense, military judges, a report of the chairperson who presided over a disciplinary hearing is awaited, or employee has still not yet been charged, but the investigation has been completed. Now, with regard to the first bullet, there is we live in a constitutional democracy. Once there is investigation followed by a disciplinary process, implicated persons by law are given certain rights to be represented either by a union, shop steward, in other cases by legal representatives. Now, where the case is that of legal representatives, but it does happen also even where shop stewards are also representatives. There is too many postponements, their diaries are full because they've got other high profile cases to deal with. Meanwhile, a disciplinary process is meant to be a very swift process that is not emulating court proceedings. It is an area as public service we need to improve on to a great extent. Now here we show the trend I've already indicated that from 2017-2018 financial year, one can think that, hey, there has been a decline. But when you take into account in the current year, the 319 cases that are still on the roll, the bar would have been almost higher than 2017-18. But unfortunately, departments could not finalize the disciplinary proceedings as required. Now we also reflect on trends relating to the outcome of this disciplinary proceedings. We indicate that there is a significant number of employees found guilty in 2017-18 to 2020-2021. The number of officials found guilty in 2021 financial year is significantly higher in that employees were found guilty in 29 cases of the 519 cases. We state this because a sanction of dismissal is regarded as the most deterrent of them all. It is regarded as punitive. So once other officials say that there is zero tolerance to maladministration of financial resources, which leads to financial misconduct, they are going to refrain from doing what they have seen people being dismissed for. Here we just reflect on the slide before you that the trends on sanctions for the period 2017-2018 financial year to 2020-2021 financial year. We reflect various sanctions where there is combination of sanctions, where there is final written warning, where there is dismissal, which is color-coded in red, and then written warning, color-coded in purple. We move on to this area, which Commissioner Boshoff elucidated on, regarding the consequence management, realizing that when we get information from departments, we always see or observe that these amounts differ with the ones that are disclosed by departments in their annual report. So as an addition to this monitoring and evaluation exercise, the PSC sought to take all annual reports and analyze them, sift through and check which amount have been highlighted as falling under unauthorized, irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. All these categories, they fall under financial misconduct. Once we do that, then we approach the departments to respond as to who has been held, who was responsible for this, for incurring this financial misconduct. How far is the investigation? How far is the disciplinary proceeding? And any criminal case reported must be shared with us, just so that we impress on the amounts that have been disclosed in the financial report. Where AG now was involved and certifying those amounts that departments are disclosing as irregular, as unauthorized, as falling under this category of financial misconduct. In terms of the consequent management, the responses we received with regard to irregular expenditure, total number of cases, we reflect there that there were 1,848 cases of irregular expenditure. Then where disciplinary action was instituted is 482, and we reflect a number of SMS. Now, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, you are going to see here the trajectory relating to SMS now is shooting up, because these are the decision makers who oversee processes to procure in the supply chain environment. And then we, with regard to fruitless and wasteful expenditure, 828 cases were identified, of which 156 disciplinary action was instituted. Of that number, there are 99 SMS members who are implicated. With regard to unauthorized expenditure, 27 cases were identified. One of them, disciplinary action was instituted, and then in this category, no SMS members were identified. Now, we reflect that an amount of just over 1 billion is 1.62 billion rand is involved in this type of cases. Then we break it down with regard to national department, which accounts for 149 million Yes, 149,272,000 rand. Then with regard to provinces, they account for 857 million rand. We move to the next slide. This is information that is reflected in the annual reports of department. And we reflect here that provincial departments for the 2019-2020 financial year, we had an amount of 103 billion rand. It's just almost not 103 billion rand, but it's 1.3, almost 1.4 billion rand. Then we go on to break it down in terms of national as well as provincial departments, where national accounts for 12,426,798,000. Then provincial accounts for 91 billion rand, 516,362,000 rand. We move on now to deal with the area of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, where we indicate that from the annual report of both national and provincial departments, in the year 2019-2020 financial year, departments reflected an amount of 2.7 billion rand in respect of fruitless and wasteful expenditure. We provide a breakdown where 798 million rand is accounted for national, 270 million rand account for the provincial department. Now, when you look at all this, it is not a small matter that we will say there is improvement in how this area is managed. There is lots of room, much work needs to be done for departments to really implement consequence management where financial misconduct is identified. It is actually a duty, it is an obligation placed upon all accounting officers to make sure that financial resources are managed effectively, they are used economically, and they are not, there is no wastage. Because that's the only way in which services will be provided to the satisfaction of the citizens of this country. The observations that some of them, Commissioner Boshoff has pointed them out, I've also hinted on why disciplinary proceedings will be postponed endlessly, which is something we are not impressed about as the Public Service Commission. And I need to indicate that during the Strat Plan, the Public Service Commission set itself to reach out to departments in areas where they are really performing dismally in complying with the requisite legislation. And one of the areas is this one of financial management. So our commissioners, resident commissioners in provinces, cluster commissioners at national, will be engaging with the relevant EAs, which are ministers and MECs, as well as I come to say, in your department, this area of consequence management is lagging behind. These are the advice we are providing to you, put in place panels that will set down hearings and listen to those hearings until they conclude instead of setting it down for 2 days. Then the hearing drags for 2-3 years because we still have cases that would emanate all the way from 2018-19, and you are told this case is still going on. It is before the chairperson of a disciplinary panel. Now, the other issue there, a chairperson of a disciplinary panel is regarded as independent, impartial, and they are doing that work neutrally. So the department are likely not to be instructing them, but it is not instruction to say we would want to see this hearing finalized swiftly, keep postponements to a bare minimum. It is not an unlawful instruction to a disciplinary panel, because that chairperson will weigh whatever presentations are made before them regarding postponements and decline it or grant it. So when we assessed this consequence management in department, we realized that there is a lot of investigations that were still going on and they are not finalized promptly because the PFMA accords only 30 days within which to finalize this. Now, also, when you place a SMS member on suspension within a set time frame, you must start with your disciplinary proceeding, and that is provided for in the regulations. So there are these bounds within which departments are operating within. It's not a free-for-all that you'll postpone endlessly without finalizing. There are resource implications here once a disciplinary hearing drags forever, because firstly, if a person is suspended, it means you are one resource down that must provide service in the department. Now, it means somebody must double up for that and they will not be paid any acting, anything. They must just assist, be patriotic, and do the work of the person who's on suspension while the disciplinary hearing is breaking on. This information we share with the Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, not to lay bare the dirty linen in the public service, but to reflect on the efficiency and effectiveness of our disciplinary or discipline management system, our consequence management system, as required by this various prescripts. We are enabling you, we are empowering you to hold these accounting officers accountable, because they are duty bound. They don't have a choice. If an accounting officer fails to take disciplinary action against implicated officials in financial misconduct, that accounting officer must be disciplined by the minister or the MEC. It is as simple as that, because some of these delays happen where you find the accounting officer, the CFO, the head of supply chain, they are all implicated, and we have seen that in most cases of the PPE fraud and corruption. You find the whole chain must be disciplined. So they dilly-dally around who must discipline and take a swift action. They delay that consequence management. So it need not be the case. And once where the accounting officer themselves are implicated, the MEC or the minister must oversee the process or appoint professionals who will oversee the process. We do have professionals in the public service. It need not entirely be the lawyers, because where lawyers are involved and the cases get postponed, they will argue due process, meanwhile they are raking in from government coffers, because for them it's money, at least not less than 8,000 a day. We move on to share some observations. We say here it is worth noting that the what is reported in the annual report and what is reported to PNC more often differs, and hence we will continue to tighten, to strengthen our utilization of the annual report, interaction with the department, so that we have full detailed information and as reflected in the report that we tabled before this parliament. We make the following recommendations. I've already alluded to the fact that an accounting officer who failed to carry out this duty-bound role, they must themselves be disciplined. It can't be anyhow. That is just the way it is. Because they are responsible also to ensure that accurate information of financial misconduct and consequence management is provided to the PSC in line with the reporting formats provided by the PSC. Now, this will enable the PSC to provide full details to this August House, to empower you to hold departments accountable. We flag the issue of non-payment where services are paid beyond 30 working days. This is the most grievous financial misconduct, because there are MMEs, small business enterprises that are just trying to get off as a way of alleviating poverty. There are these frameworks in our setup. Now they have rendered services, they are not being paid. The ultimate destination will be they will be stifled out of business into poverty, because they are not going to be able to sustain the high competitive nature of the business world. Honorable Chair, I think I've reached the conclusion of what we needed to share with yourself and honorable members of your committee. Thank you very much for the audience, for the privilege given to us. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Given this picture that you have painted here, do we have a public service that is alive to its responsibilities? Do we have a public service that is responsive? That those are the two questions that I have on my side. And then I will go to members. I see Honorable Kibi and Honorable Dooley, Honorable Gondwe.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I don't know what is up with this gadget. Honorable Chair, thank you. Let me welcome and appreciate the presentation on financial misconduct. Honorable Chair, really looking at the number of cases on financial misconduct tells you clearly that it's now fashionable to be a part of the people that are misbehaving when they see money or whatever. And my concern is also that it's about the huge amounts of money that cannot be recovered And those are monies that could have changed the lives of the people outside there. It's really concerning, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, I think we need to get maybe a plan and ask the presenters and the team, what do they think can be done on the delays of the cases because of representatives that are postponing cases because they are busy with something else that they need to attend to. And this is definitely happening in a situation where people are being suspended with pay. To me, it's just to buy time. Honorable Chair, in slide 5, they mentioned that 24 departments were unable to submit reports on the financial misconduct. My question is, what kind of communication method was used to request accounting officers' information pertaining to the financial misconduct? Are there any reasons provided by these departments for not complying with PSC requirements? What could be the consequences for accounting officers of the department who were unable to submit information to the PSC? Chair, with regard to the type of misconduct committed, did the PSC conduct further fact-finding mission to understand the root causes of this financial misconduct among public servants? Over 298 employees were found guilty. Is there uniformity in terms of sanctions given by various disciplinary committees across government departments? What can be done to categorize sanctions emanating from disciplinary committees or the panels to avoid arriving at different outcomes in Department A, maybe with the next department, that is maybe your Department B, on more or less the same offences? My other one, Honourable Chair, it was indicated that a high amount by national departments was a result of the Department of Higher Education, which related to fraud and irregular expenditure amounting to that high amount. These numbers are too much. Now, my question is, when was this fraud committed in the Department of Higher Education? Was the official involved suspended with pay or without pay? The next one, what was the outcome of the disciplinary case on the fraud and irregular expenditure in the Department of Higher Education? I thank you, Honorable Chair.
Honorable Ntuli.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, we welcome the presentation by Public Service Commission. Chairperson, Honorable KB covered me on the postponement and buying time. But I wanted to add on saying, she covered me on, I think, in just few questions, like higher education. I think higher education, also there was a question in Parliament that was asked about this one from the minister. And also the four departments, for the non-compliance. But I want to start here, Chair, from the Service Commission. Public Commission to say will public commission ever have teeth? Because if you can see the work that has been done by the public commission, then they just recommend. Is there any intention for this commission to have one day, so that this huge task that they've started, they are able to complete? Because they recommend and leave it like that, not knowing whether it is going to be taken as serious as they've done the work. Chair, I'm very much concerned by the number, like Makibi. The number is too high. But it reflected again that sometimes you think that this is the number, whereas other cases are not reflecting. What then happens when a public commission finds out that this is not the number, but they are other cases that are still hidden, or that are not still not reflecting? Again, one is very much worried about the number of senior management implicated, 99 implicated. To say it's very sad that really my question earlier on is about the kids of this to say, does a public service commission do a follow up thereafter, even if it's not them who are going to execute on those cases, but do they do follow up to see the completion or the tail end? Chair, the importance of consequence and management is very is highly needed here, or is highly observed, not needed, it's highly observed. Now, when are we going to, as you are giving us this information, we are with the department here. I think some of the things should overlap to the department. If the public commission can't go any further, when is this consequence management going to be there as a framework for everyone? And then, Jefferson, it's the number here of them. The maladministration of finances is rife here. That's why I said earlier on, it overlaps to the department. If we still have misappropriation of funds, people borrowing themselves, what do you recommend on such people? Because really, for me, you can't take government money, borrow yourself, wait for your salary. Your salary comes. It's a stop sale of some sort. Yes. What do you recommend on such cases? And really, it is overlapping to the department to say, department, we've got the elephant in the room. Thank you to Public Service Commission. Because even on that end, by time, how do we discipline those people who are buying time, who are delaying things? How do you discipline those people? And who's supposed to discipline them, by the way? What do you recommend here? Because I think if it can be known that you, well, if we told a Public Service Commission that our diaries are full, they are going to wait for us. What do you recommend? Because somebody should whip on this thing. It's going to be a norm that the cases will go over and over while people are suspended with pay and while people are milking the government. Chair, yeah, I think I can pause on that one. I can come back to you.
Honorable Conduit. Yeah, Chairperson, I have a number of questions for the Public Service Commission. The first one relates to the 24 departments that failed to submit reports, and I want to find out whether the reasons were given for the non-submission of reports on their finances in this regard, and what interventions have the Public Service Commission put in place in an effort to address the non-submission of reports by departments. Are they trying to engage principals and impressing upon principals, we need these reports around financial misconduct, to be submitted to us, because it worries me that, government departments, and heads are always aware that there is, there are certain reports that need to be, submitted, and compliance is always an issue. And then in the presentation, they indicate that criminal action was instituted in only 35 cases of the completed cases of financial misconduct in the financial year under consideration. Is this 35 out of 519 completed cases? Because if this is the case, then this number is disturbingly low, as only 6% of the cases resulted in criminal sanction. And I want to know what type of financial misconduct did the majority of these 35 cases, concern. Chairperson, I also find it concerning that misappropriation accounted for the highest number of cases on financial misconduct. And I want to understand what we mean by the word misappropriation, because misappropriation is defined as an act of stealing something that you've been trusted to take care of and you use it for yourself. And if we have to put it plainly, it's just another word of saying that you've stolen, or you cannot really tell someone what you've done with the money that you've been entrusted with. So I want to get an idea of what we mean when we say misappropriation. I'm also concerned that the most prevalent sanction, method out in this sense was a final warning. even where monies were misappropriated. But I also take comfort in the fact that the second most prevalent sanction was dismissals. However, I would like to see more criminal sanctions being meted out against public servants who commit serious acts of financial misconduct, such as fraud. Now, the presentation indicates that 945 million was the total amount of money involved in completed disciplinary cases. And national departments account for over half of this amount, which is 585 million to be precise. And they further indicate in the presentation that this figure is high because of the 181 million that the Department of Higher Education incurred due to fraud and irregular expenditure. I would just like more information around this 181 million and how it was incurred. The presentation also indicates that 160 million was recovered. And I just want to get clarity whether this is 167 million out of 945 million, because, you know, this effectively means that we could not recover the remaining 728 million. I'm also shocked that only half a million rands was recovered from provinces in this regard. How do we improve the recovery rate? Where a person is deemed guilty of financial misconduct, why is that person not required to pay back the money, you know, if they cannot account for what, you know, what they did, you know, with that money? Should the sanction, you know, not be coupled with the recovery of the money? So in other words, paying back the money, shouldn't paying back the money be part and parcel of the sanction that, you know, meted out? And then the presentation indicates that 319 disciplinary proceedings were not completed. Again, I want to find out, is this 319 out of the 519 completed, not completed disciplinary cases? Because if this is the case, then 61% of these cases could not be completed. And this is very discouraging, you know, but also not surprising, as we have a backlog of disciplinary cases in the public service. And, you know, you also indicate that the Department of Defense accounted for the majority of uncompleted cases. And I want to find out why. Is it because, you know, DOD uses, you know, I think it's called a martial system of law. I just want to get to the bottom of why DOD accounted for this number. House Chairperson, 1 billion in unauthorized expenditure, and provinces account for the majority of this amount, namely 857 million. I have to ask, what is really going on in our provinces, and why is there no amount reflected under the Eastern Cape? It's just, you know, a dash under the Eastern Cape, and there's nothing reflected. 1 billion in irregular expenditure across all government departments, and provinces account for most of this irregular expenditure. That is 91 million. Again, I have to ask, what is really going on in our provinces? I mean, should the Public Service Commission not be calling for urgent intervention by the executive in this regard? 2 billion in fruitless and wasteful expenditure across all departments, and national departments account for 798 million of this. Provincial departments account for 270 million of this amount. This is money that could be going towards the building of roads and other important infrastructure, but it's all being wasted. I think, how, you know, Chairperson, there's a need for us to see how we can urgently, you know, call for some kind of interventions or measures to be put in place. Otherwise, we'll be failing in our function as a committee to hold, you know, the executive accountable and departments accountable. This is money, taxpayers' money, money that you and I work very hard day in and day out for, and yet it's just being, you know, wasted. I mean, this is hemorrhaging, serious hemorrhaging in the public service. And we have to find a way to ensure that we put a stop to this, you know, and not always just address the symptoms and not actually get to the bottom of why we have this problem. But I'm shocked. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Honorable Mutepe.
Thank you very much, my Honorable Chairperson.
I've got two questions here. The first one is, a total of 319 disciplinary proceedings were reported as not completed. The department with high number of pending disciplinary cases have ethics officers. Is there any consequences management of failure to discipline officials found to have committed financial misconduct within 90 days? Who should be held responsible for such a failure to discipline officials? The other one is, a large number of departments submit reports indicating that there are no disciplinary proceedings completed or not completed, whilst the very same department have a high number of cases. Can the accounting officer be punished for failure to discipline public servants? The last one is, on the report was said that there are employees who have passed on, and then some have resigned, and then some have retired. So for those who are still alive, who are retired, and who are on pension, can't, because they have committed financial misconduct, there is nothing that can be done. Can't be any retrieval for any amount that they, for any misconduct they have committed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Ntuli. Honorable Ntuli, is that a legacy hand or?
Yeah, I'm so sorry, Chair. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I will now give the public service opportunity to respond to questions raised by honorable members. But it is a pity that the I'm going to characterize the public service in the manner I'm going to do, because the I can you are not empowered as a public service commission yourselves to take disciplinary action against the offenders, against departments that are failing to do what they are supposed to do. And in my view, you are the police without handcuffs. You are the police without veils. Thank you. You can respond. That is my characterization of yourselves.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, for these pointed questions. I'll just reflect on two and allow my colleagues to take the rest. The first one, there was a time when the Auditor General didn't have peace. They were merely lamenting at the end of the financial year. And now the legislation was made for them to have teeth. Similarly, the Public Service Commission, the range of legislative reforms that could give teeth. At that moment, we will be able to remove the gum shield that we have and start biting. But that can only happen in the ecosystem of us working very closely with Parliament and with the executives. But we have not waited for that to happen. We have been quite creative in a way. For an example, every month now we're meeting with three or four ministers and their own officials, of course, in the provinces, the same is taking place. And that in itself is to raise issues which sometimes land with the executives, but do not go all the way to the minister concerned, but also raise the issue of consequences of not attending to some of the reports and the issues that were raised. The second part, it is now clear if one analyzes the Auditor General reports as well as many other reports of corruption, that the weakest link in each one of the departments is the weakness in the human resource units, whether we call it corporate services or any other name, because it is where consequence management, performance bonuses, and the issue of arbitration, reconciliation, conflict management is taking place. And it is where succession planning, getting the right skills for the right reasons, it is where all these litigations are managed. If you have a weakness in that particular unit, including training, capacity building, and many others, it's going to have a cancerous impact on the rest of the department. A bulk of grievances, the bulk of complaints that come our way always go to that particular space. And the point raised by Honorable Gondwe, I think it is only fair to say, and the point you've made is the one we're making, if people believe that the threshold or the punishment is so weak that you gain more by committing a crime, then you are likely to just continue committing a crime. Therefore, there is a need to review even the penalties that are given so that it's not just a slap on the wrist. That in itself will go a long way. But again, for all these to take place, we ought to be saying in the ecosystem of monitoring, of evaluation, all different role players should be working together. And I'm sure the introduction of lifestyle audit is another added layer to make sure that we do not see the kinds of things that we are seeing. And lastly, the bulk of public servants, the question you raised, Honorable Chair, are quite dedicated people who want to do their work. But once you do have people in strategic places within the public service placed who are crooked, they then bring the entire system into a space of reputational risk, because the impact of the few who steal blemishes the rest, and sometimes may even lead to low morale of those who are simply trying to do their work. Thank you, Chair. I'll give now to Commissioner Boshoff and colleagues.
Commissioner Boshoff, you can take the platform.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm just going to add one or two things to what Professor Fikeni said, and then I'm going to request Mr. Malatsi just to address the technical issues, more information on the higher education matter, when was the alleged fraud committed and by whom, also the definition of misappropriation, and then also those technical questions that Honorable Gondwe asked with regards to the number of disciplinary cases and the number of cases in provinces and so on. Just those technical questions, if Mr. Malatsi can just respond to that. But Chairperson, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, Professor Fikeni is absolutely correct. To respond to the Chairperson's very first, the Chairperson of the Committee's very first question on whether we have a responsive public service and whether we have a public service that is aware of all these challenges, absolutely, Chair, absolutely. We have a very dedicated public service. We have dedicated public servants, but there are bad apples. You know, there are departments, there are accounting officers who are not responsive, who do not perhaps have the will to provide us with the information. And that is something we want the committee to take note of. It has indeed become fashionable, chairperson, as one of the members said, to misbehave in the public service. And, you know, there's huge amounts of money that need to be recovered, but are not recovered. And for the commission, that is very, very concerning. On the communication methods, well, we on a regular basis, and when I started with the introduction, I indicated that we receive information from departments, or we request information from departments on a quarterly basis, not only on an annual basis. And that is followed up with telephone calls and with more letters and so on. And based on our communication methods, information is received that is possible to provide you with this report. The root causes for this financial misconduct, Chair, I just don't think there's proper ethics where it is required, and we need to restore ethical behavior in the public service. If one looks at the amounts, it's huge amounts of money that we've mentioned. The money, the reports, Chair, the information reflected on this slide is absolutely accurate, and it's very, very concerning, and it's the Commission is very concerned about the information that we are sharing with the Portfolio Committee today. On uniformity in sanctions, Chair, that is the ideal. Unfortunately, at the moment, you know, presiding officers determine the sanctions. But what is even more concerning, Chair, is something that the committee should take note of, is we have, over a period of time, and remember, it's not the first time that we are presenting this report to the Portfolio Committee, over a very long period of time, the trend that we have identified is that it's normally your lower level employees, you know, below the level of junior management and lower, who normally get disciplined for financial misconduct. Your senior managers, you know, somebody must have signed something somewhere, but your senior managers, you know, there's a reluctance to discipline senior managers in the public service. You see a lot of junior staff being disciplined and being dismissed. That was is a concern that we've also brought to the attention of provincial legislatures. The chairperson of the commission, the acting chair of the commission, has referred to the issue of teeth. At the moment, the constitution is very clear with regards to our powers and issuing of recommendations. We are hoping to address that in the near future. You're aware of a draft bill that we will that will hopefully be tabled very, very soon. We are worried about the number of senior managers being implicated, honourable members, but we are of the view that it's still not enough. We think that the junior staff members are made scapegoats, and that remains a concern. Do we follow up? Do we communicate what we have presented to the Portfolio Committee today? Honourable Chairperson, these reports also get tabled in provincial legislatures. And the Public Service Commission also gets the opportunity to present these reports in the identified portfolio committees of the provincial legislatures. So what we are presenting today, we are also presenting in portfolio committees of provincial legislatures. And most of the time, provincial departments get invited to these meetings. And our findings, our concerns, the fact that there's no consequence management or insufficient consequence management, that is reported to portfolio committees of provincial legislatures as well. So departments are well aware of the concerns of the commission. It does happen at provincial level as well. I think I will stop there, Honourable Chairperson, and request Mr. Malachi just to address the technical issues as well. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Malachi. You can take the floor.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Let me start with the question which Honourable Kibi raised on what mechanisms do we use to communicate. We write letters to accounting officers. They know they are duty bound. We write to them frequently on a quarterly basis, but we interact as well with ethics officers. There are designated nodal points in departments on a number of issues we interact. So those departments reflected as not having submitted were adequately contacted and reminded. They just didn't cooperate. They just didn't cooperate. And now Prof. Figeni indicated there that there is an effort to interact, to reach out to this department, talk to, engage with the principals, which are ministers, as well as the accounting officers. But as that happens, accounting officers will need to be accountable, will need to be held accountable for this failure. Otherwise, there will be a recurrence. The root cause, when looking at the types of the transgressions, in work environment, fraud occurs, there is a fraud troika, which requires that the internal control must be tight. There must not be an opportunity. And the people working in that area where lifestyle audit comes in must manage their finances properly. They mustn't live beyond their means. Because once they do that, they will have pressing needs. If they have parties, they live beyond their means, then they have this pressing needs. And once the opportunity arises and there is lack of internal control, they are going to help themselves. And that will be demonstrated from the example of higher education that I'm going to give. That amount involves five officials, two of which were at level 8, one at level 9, the other one middle management level 12, with one being CFO at level 15. Now, the ones at level 8 and level 12, they overpaid their salaries. Fraud is something that you are able to execute on the system on your own. So you gain by deceit, by manipulating the system, meaning there were no checks and balances. And that's why segregation of duties is such an important internal control mechanism that should not be compromised, whether there is staff or no staff. There must be a role assigned for segregation of duties purposes. The one who captures cannot be the one who authorizes it, because that will lead to chaos. People will pay themselves, and when you realize it's way too after a period that you find they've used millions that they cannot replace. The level 15 CFO contracted, he awarded a tender to the bidder who did not score the highest point. He was
found guilty and was fired in the process. The area of recovery still reflects 0-0, as meaning that no monies were recovered from him. The same with level 12, was involved in overpayment of salary. He was suspended without pay and required to repay all the monies that were found. And this calls on now that issue of consistency of sanctions. In our law, there is a principle that each case must be adjudicated on its own merit. Although you will use certain precedents, especially in once you are in a department, you check how that department has been dealing with its cases, but you can also look in other departments because public service is one. There is an issue that was raised about those who resign amid disciplinary action. What then? Is there a recourse? There has been several cases where accounting officers' pension payouts were not processed pending finalization of their cases relating to financial misconduct. Now, because those cases were still going on, I'm not at liberty to be saying which one and which one. And one was in the Department of Correctional Services, and that matter is still sub judice, where parties are disputing before an appropriate dispute resolution panel. So there is no, we cannot say there is no mechanism whatsoever. There is no recourse because as we work, there is savings that we are making in the pension benefits. And fortunately, our courts have now started to look into this thing and say, no, once you have messed up and you leave, one department should not pay out until that matter is resolved, so that whatever is owed in your name can get paid back to the department. I'm just checking for one more, if there are areas of technical. There was also a question that was raised. What plan? Can you give us a plan that will enable us to intervene on this? We will put a plan together. We normally give it to the MPSA, Minister of the Public Service and Administration, who's the lead in the public service, and the minister will be the one coming to table it before the committee on how that can be implemented. I can just say that in the Eastern Cape, way back, there was a similar lots of disciplinary cases not finalized, those that were finalized, inconsistent application and no recovery. There was an intervention management strategy that was put in place that in a year's time dealt with all those cases, filed all the reports, ensured that the appropriate action can be taken against the implicated people. So we will put that plan or more or less similar plan that we will submit through our principals to the MPSA to consider how it can be taken forward. But the chair and honorable members will be appraised of that as well. I think I can end here. I've dealt with those technical questions that needed to be responded to. Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members of your committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you, honorable members. Thank you, Professor Sifikeni.
and your team have done very well today. It's now 6 minutes past 1, and we have concluded the business of the day. I want to congratulate all of you for this excellent work today. We have now come to the end of the portfolio committee meeting, and I therefore declare the meeting closed. Have a very good journey back to your places. Take care. Thank you very much. Meeting is now adjourned.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.